Hi friends, new and regular listeners. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from Göteborg in Sweden. We do radio programs on a wide variety of subjects, all that we consider to be of interest and of importance. I guess you can say compared to the junk that you are being fed from the mainstream media news sources. And we do like to focus on things of importance, but also on things that hopefully will engage you to ponder a little bit more and philosophize a little bit more as well. So it's good to have you all with us today, and I hope that you are comfortable wherever you are in the world and ready for another interesting radio program. If you're new to Red Ice, the website or this radio program, I suggest you go over to the website and read more about what we do and take a look around. Check through our free radio archive with a year of radio programs up there for you, and check out our members area as well if you want to expand your horizon even more. The website is redicecreations.com. And today we have a guest back with us on the show that we haven't had on the program for about 2 years now. We have occult history author Peter Levenda joining us today. He, of course, is the author of the acclaimed Sinister Forces trilogy and also Unholy Alliance, a history of the Nazi involvement with the occult. And not only we have been hungry to get Peter back on the program, but also many of our listeners have requested that we invite Peter back to talk about some of his more recent work. He's released 3 books since we last talked. The Mao of Business, Guerrilla Trade Techniques for the New China, Stairway to Heaven, Chinese Alchemists, Jewish Kabbalists, and the Art of Spiritual Transformation. And his latest one is on the Masons, called The Secret Temple, Masons, Mysteries, and the Founding of America. And the last book here that we mentioned, The Secret Temple, is something that I'd like to go into in our second hour together with Peter and focus on the Masons. But for those of you who want to check out his website, pop on over to sinisterforces.info. It seems to be tricky to get on there at the moment. But if you do want to get more information right away about his new books, I suggest you check out the links that we are going to provide for you on our website, directed to Amazon. And of course, going to our archive and check out our program that we did with Peter back in 2007, then specifically about the Sinister Forces trilogy. But with that, welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Peter, and thank you for coming on again and spending some of your time with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it the last time. I'm sure I'm going to enjoy it this time.
Excellent. Thank you, Peter. And, you know, I'd like to begin to talk a little bit about Stairway to Heaven, Chinese Alchemists, Jewish Kabbalists, and the Art of Spiritual Transformation. Again, here then, with the exception of your new book on the Mason, you've obviously kind of shifted your focus over to China in your two books before that, before the latest one. And maybe you can just tell us a little bit about that and why you've been wanting to look at China, and maybe if the evidence, so to speak, that you've been following have been leading you there, or if there's something else that has allured you to look at this Eastern country.
Well, I've been involved with China for quite a long time. I studied Mandarin back in the 1970s in New York City. And then beginning in 1984, I started to do business in China, working with a small export company located about 2 blocks from the World Trade Center in New York City. So from that point, I began to become very heavily involved in China trade. But the reason for my studying Mandarin back in the 1970s had nothing to do with business. I wanted to study books that had not been translated yet about Chinese alchemy. I felt that this was a very interesting area of research that had been neglected by Western scholars for the most part. So I began to study Chinese, and that sort of, after a while, led me into doing business in China for this small company. So I've been doing business there since 1984 until today. So that's about 25 years of working in China. But the business in China gave me the opportunity to visit a lot of the temples and sacred sites in China that still exist. Many of them, of course, were destroyed during the Cultural Revolution or during the revolution itself. Many were closed down, turned into other things. But there were a handful of very interesting temples that were still left, Taoist temples, some Confucian temples, some Chinese Buddhist temples. So I made that part of my work when I was doing business in China. I always found time to visit these temples and to find out what was still going on. In addition, I went to Taiwan, other places in Southeast Asia, and I lived in Malaysia for 7 years. And that allowed me to travel in that area and to do a lot of research on Asian occultism, let's say Asian esoteric arts, which I think have a lot to tell us about Western esoteric arts as well. There's a continuum of knowledge and practice that I find very striking.
Very interesting. And you know, before we get into the Chinese alchemy topic, I just want to ask you, I guess generally, since you've been doing business now then for about 25 years in China, how have you seen it change in the last, I guess we can focus on the last 10 or 15 years or so, and there's a tremendous amount of money obviously pouring in from the Western world into China. What's your overarching perception of the country? Where is it heading? Considering, I guess, its communist, alleged communist roots, it's a extremely capitalist country, obviously. Where do you see things are going with that, Peter?
Well, when I first went to China in the 80s, the place was a very mysterious, very cold, very secretive sort of place. It was, you would land in the middle of the night in Beijing, and you would take a taxi to your hotel, and you saw nothing but darkness. You saw no street lights. You would see fires burning in the distance. You didn't know what was going on. It was like a bad Blade Runner film. And then from that point until now, the transformation has been absolutely unbelievable. I don't think any country in the world has seen that massive amount of transformation, at least in the major cities. I think the countryside is struggling to catch up. But in the major cities like Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou, you'll see just tremendous growth and tremendous modernization. The problem is it's creating a kind of spiritual crisis, I believe, for the Chinese people. In the old days when I would take Chinese delegations to the West, we would visit New York or some other Western city. We would visit a famous church like St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. And the Chinese delegation members would walk into this building and I would lead them around and they would come back out and say, what is the purpose of this building? Is it a meeting hall? They had absolutely no concept because religion had been effectively wiped out under Mao and since then. So that there is no moral structure in China beyond the Communist Party. That's the tricky thing. The Communist Party is struggling to maintain power, and of course they still have power. They have government power, political power. Economic power is questionable, but they can still call the shots. If China loses the Communist Party, I wonder what will replace it as their moral or ethical philosophy, because religion has fallen by the wayside. There is a kind of Christian resurgence there. There is a bit of Buddhism coming back, mostly for the tourists. A lot of tourists from Taiwan and Hong Kong and Chinese people from the Chinese diaspora around the world love to go to China to visit the temples, so they've reopened many of these temples. But I don't think the Chinese people themselves feel any particular attraction to all of this religion that is being promoted for the tourists. So it will be interesting to me to see what happens. What is it? I mean, is capitalism itself necessarily atheistic? If it is, then China will be the dominant force in the world in the years to come. And this is what I'm watching very carefully.
By the way, you mentioned a little bit about the buildings and so forth. How generally, what can you say about the architecture that is springing up over there in terms of the new developments and the new buildings? Is it dry? Is it, as we perceive of the Soviet-style communistic era, very, very dry and very kind of efficient, as you said?
Well, all of the architecture back in the 80s was just exactly that, Soviet-style architecture, virtually anywhere in the country. They were copying the Soviets. Of course, the Soviets were present there in China in large numbers as engineers, as trading partners. So it was very Soviet style. Now the architecture is phenomenal. There are building skyscrapers everywhere. If you go to Shanghai, to the Pudong district, which is the new sort of industrial zone, commercial zone, banking zone, you will find block after block after block of new skyscrapers, each one different. Each one different, with a different design, different color schemes, different architecture completely. You will not see two buildings identical anywhere. It is a strange, very strange experience because they're creating a city out of nothing. They're creating an entire culture out of out of nothing, out of thin air. So they're free to do whatever they like. And it's I recommend a visit to Shanghai, to Pudong, just to see the possibilities that exist in China today.
Incredible. And that is, I mean, Shanghai is, if not already, then the biggest shipping city in the world, I think. And it's growing tremendously, as you say. Do you think that is primarily, as I mentioned before, Western money behind this, or are the Chinese now doing this on their own since they've gotten the backing to start up this kind of experiment from the West?
Well, a lot of the money is their own at this point. As we know in the United States, famously, they hold roughly $1 trillion of foreign currency, most of it American debt. So it depends on your point of view. Is it Western currency? Yeah, possibly, but it's money that we owe to the Chinese because of our demand for their exports. So their export culture has always been very strong. At this point, though, they're not relying upon exports so much. They have developed such an internal market, the way in the United States, their biggest market was internal. Now in China, it's taking over gradually. They're building a middle class. So they are building a large a base of their own businesses, which are growing by leaps and bounds. And they're still strong economically as far as exports are concerned. So what used to be foreign economic investment back in the 80s and the 90s is now being gradually replaced by local Chinese direct investment. It's an interesting segue that's taking place.
So let's get into Chinese alchemy a little bit. I mean, I know that the roots are what I thought at least were more Eastern, implying the Arabic root of the word alchemy, of course. But I didn't know that the Chinese kind of had their own version. Is that how it's been developed, or did they the Chinese precede the Arabic and Middle Eastern type of alchemy, Peter?
Well, it's an interesting segue because in speaking of alchemy, we're talking about changing base material into gold, and that seems to be what China is doing these days. They're able to perform an alchemical transformation in their own society, which is, I think, in my mind, which is connecting all of these concepts. Chinese alchemy was largely concerned with human health as opposed to actually changing lead into gold. To the Chinese alchemists, they understood that was a metaphor. But for them, gold was immortality. And to the Chinese, immortality did not mean to live forever, but it did mean to live for hundreds of years. The ability to prolong life indefinitely, to live healthy indefinitely. And they believed, just as the many Western alchemists did, that this involved using very dangerous chemicals, like poisons, but in very strictly controlled dosages to increase life. But it was also a mystical and spiritual quest as well. So you had meditations that were devoted to the astronomical constellations, to the groupings of stars. There was a lot of mysticism based on the Big Dipper, what we call the Big Dipper, which they called by various names, one of them being the Chariot of the North. This was a vehicle. The Chinese understood that this constellation was a vehicle towards the North Star that would lead you to the North Star. And the North Star was the axis of the universe because it did not rise, it did not set. The North Star was a constant. So it was the symbol to them of immortality. As I began to go from the Chinese alchemical texts and start to read texts from India, from Egypt, from Babylonia, from other places, I saw a constant consistency between all of these ideas, that everyone had a mysticism based around this particular constellation and the North Star. And that's what led to the thesis that I propose in Stairway to Heaven, is that this is the constellation par excellence. This is what mystics around the world have focused on and have encoded it in different ways. There are seven stars, and there are seven stages to the alchemical process and seven stages to the mystical process, things like that.
Interesting. And do they overall have a different zodiac than the Western world does as well? Do they have the classical 12 constellation, or is that different as well?
Well, they have their own complete different star charts. So they saw the stars in different clusters than we did. They gave them different names, different ideas. As we know, there's a Chinese zodiac, but it's all various animals. as far as the Western zodiac is concerned, that was adopted, but adopted much later. So they had their own astronomy and their own astrology, which was separate. And this is what's interesting to me. Many cultures had separate approaches to the zodiac, separate approaches to the stars in general. But they all seemed to agree on this one particular constellation, and they all gave it the same name. They all called it a chariot or a wagon, something that implied a vehicle. And they all referred to it this way, whether it was in the east or the west. They seemed to agree on that. They may disagree on everything else, but they agreed on the identification of this particular constellation as somehow a vehicle towards spiritual transformation.
Is that connected to the ladder as well of the seven stars?
Yes, it's the same thing to me. It's the ladder of lights. It's it all is consistent. I looked at the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament. This is what actually got me thinking along these lines. And Ezekiel is very clear. He says on a particular day, month, and year, it's one of the few places in the entire Bible where they're that specific. On this day, month, and year, in this place, in Babylon, he was in the Babylonian captivity. He looked towards the north, specifically, and he had this particular vision. Well, he was looking towards that constellation, and the vision he had was of an angel or a god sitting in a throne in a chariot, which had wheels. And he's describing, to my mind, that constellation. Later mystics, Jewish mystics, would refer to this type of mysticism as Merkava mysticism. And Merkava is the chariot. And there was a whole idea based, a whole method, a whole process of Merkava mysticism, which is that there were seven levels, perhaps seven chariots, seven palaces, seven throne rooms, that led you gradually to complete communication with God. And this idea of the seven levels, I often wondered why the number seven. Most people will say, well, seven planets and, you know, the 7 days of the week. But that's putting the cart before the horse, no pun intended. The seven planets, the ancient people were not quite that stupid. They did know the sun and moon were different from the other five planets you could see with the naked eye. They did not confuse them all and say they were all equal, they were all the same. They knew better than that, and any research will tell you that in the ancient texts, they're very clear about it. So if it's not the seven planets, then what was it? And gradually I came to the understanding that it was this particular constellation. Once I understood Chinese alchemy, revered it, and they literally have a mystical process in which they walk on the stars. They have a diagram on the ground, which is the diagram of that constellation, of what we call the Big Dipper. And then they will walk from star to star to star in a mystical pattern, gradually reaching the final destination, which is the North Star. I saw exactly the same technique being used by Jewish mystics in the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries of the Common Era. So somehow in Palestine, and in China, at the same time, they're performing the same type of mystical journey. And I think they were not in communication. They were not exchanging notes in those days. So I think this was an independently arrived at idea that somehow that constellation referenced spiritual integration, spiritual transformation, and communication with the divine.
Where have you gone to kind of get some information about these? Are there libraries in China where you can still find some of these texts, or have you maybe directly gone to a few alchemists that still are around in China, or is this suppressed and under the communist regime in any way, Peter?
Well, Mao very famously attacked Taoism and Confucianism, but especially Taoism and Lao Tzu and the teachings of Taoism, because he said this was putting the individual ahead of society. So he was constantly denigrating this process. And for decades after, Taoism was rigorously suppressed. It's only now gradually in China that you can talk about these things more or less openly. And there are scholarly conferences now in China in which these things are discussed. People are seeing benefit in at least examining this without actually practicing any of it. I think you will find more of the texts in the Chinese diaspora, in Taiwan, in Singapore, and places like that. You will find practicing Taoists who are following this alchemical process. You will find some of the texts still around. And in the West, there is a growing tradition of scholarship with a handful of scholars, really, who are really researching this very, very carefully, and they're translating a lot of the most important texts. So this is becoming more and more available now.
Why do you think these traditions then have developed independently of each other? How come that humanity on different places on Earth seem to come to the same kind of mythological symbols and the same spiritual concepts and ideas? Do you have a theory or any kind of explanation, I guess, for that?
Well, one thing is true. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere, if you live above the equator, everyone shares something in common, and that is the North Star and the Big Dipper. You can see it from anywhere on Earth above the equator. So since most of the civilizations that we're talking about developed in the Northern Hemisphere, whether it's China, India, European cultures, you're going to automatically be aware of this North Star and the constellation. This is particularly so if you are traveling, if you're at sea. You need the North Star for navigation purposes. Everyone used it for that reason. Even if you're in the desert, in the Middle East, you would need to have the stars as your guide for navigation. So I think gradually the need of these stars for navigation, for finding your place, for orienting you on the earth, then also became connected to ideas of spiritual direction and spiritual orientation. I think it was natural. I think that this was something that grew naturally in all of these various civilizations. I think that it's a stunning thing if you think about it, because we today, we rarely look up. We don't look up at all. I mean, we are looking at our computer screens, or we're watching television, or we're looking on the streets of the cities where we live to make sure we're not being robbed or something. So we're not standing on a street corner and staring up. Even if we did, in a modern city, you couldn't see the stars because of all the light that's generated and pollution. It's difficult to see the sky. You have to be removed from major metropolitan areas to even think about the stars. So it's hard for us to put ourselves in that mental mindset that the ancient people had of a couple of thousand years ago. But for them, the stars were their part of their daily life. And I think this is why this kind of mysticism was created in different cultures.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we're watching the stars on TV these days instead of the heavens.
Yes,
but,
right.
You know, do you think that this as well, then, as you mentioned and alluded to a little bit earlier, that this is something on the way out in China? Their spiritual tradition is going out the door, so to speak, because of the fact that they're being so intensely industrialized and modernized.
Well, yes, this is concerning me. I mean, they had this enormous break beginning with the revolution. You know, beginning in 1949, suddenly religion was, as Marx said, it became the opiate of the people. So religion was suppressed. Although the constitution of China famously allows freedom of religion, that's only on paper. In actual practice, it was quite different. You could not be a party member, a member of the Communist Party, if you were also going to a church or a temple. I mean, you automatically would lose your status. And to be a party member in China was extremely important, and it still is in many cases. So religion was suppressed for maybe 50 years. It was almost impossible to speak openly about religion. Look at the suppression of Falun Gong, for instance, in China.
Yeah.
It would seem to be a harmless cult of people performing a kind of yoga and tai chi and meditation, but somehow this to the Chinese appeared to be a kind of movement that was politically dangerous. So you have this idea that that religion is something that should be controlled by the state, the Dalai Lama being another famous example. And when the Panchen Lama was identified some years ago, which is the second most powerful Lama in Tibet, the Chinese kidnapped him. And named their own Panchen Lama. So they wanted to be, they actually want to control the Tibetan Buddhist religious hierarchy. I mean, this is the concept you're dealing with in China. So religion is going to be problematic. It's going to remain problematic there for a while, which means that these practices will be conducted in secret in China if they even survive. They may survive only outside in places like Taiwan or Singapore or in Chinese communities around the world. Mm. In China itself, we're facing some difficulties there where this is concerned. And they have a political agenda in China. They have an economic agenda. They don't have a religious agenda except, you know, to control religion when it rears its ugly head, you know.
Yes, and of course, as you mentioned, the suppression of different types of religion. And again, what about the Tibet question? I mean, this is something that's been going on now for years. And do you have an explanation, I guess, for that? Why is China so interested in Tibet and taking over that region and suppressing the teachings and what comes out of there, so to speak?
Well, the Tibetan government was an alien government. As far as China was concerned, Tibet was part of China historically. The Chinese party line, literally, the party line, is that Tibet is Chinese territory. Naturally, if you ask the Tibetans, they don't know where that came from. At one point, there was an exchange of brides, you know, where there was a Chinese princess who married a Tibetan king. I mean, there's some various strange old historical ideas making Tibet part of China. But the problem was, after the revolution took place, in the 1950s, China was extremely nervous about its borders, especially with India. It was necessary for them, in their mind, to take over Tibet and to make it part of China and to eradicate the government that was there, because it was not a Chinese government. It was a religious theocracy, and religion was being banned, maybe not literally, but figuratively was being banned. And, of course, any alien government within Chinese borders would be suppressed. So it was just a combination of things. Plus, the Chinese were able to convince their own people that the Tibetans were basically savages who were committing human sacrifice and cannibalism. And they were able to do this because there is a tradition in Tibet of using body parts as religious implements. So, for instance, the skull could be used as a sacrificial or a ceremonial cup. Thigh bones could be transformed into trumpets, flutes, in order to summon spirits and to perform sacred music during rituals. So you'll find, you know, skulls being made into drums. So all of this paraphernalia, of course, existed in Tibetan temples. So the Chinese government, the Chinese army, when they came in, used this as an example to prove to the Chinese that they had saved the Tibetan people from these vicious, man-eating, cannibalistic, human sacrifice-offering lamas that were controlling the country. So there's a lot there, and I've spoken to many Chinese in China over the years who firmly believe that, number one, Tibet is part of China, there's no question, and that, number two, the Tibetan government, the lamas, the religious hierarchy, were savages and were suppressing their own people and economically suppressing them, and also in many other ways. I mean, there's all kinds of stories about sexual abuse and political, economic abuse, all sorts of things, all sorts of corruption. So these stories are long. They go on forever. And there is some, you know, fire where all this smoke is concerned. There were things that were done. Tibet was not this glorious kingdom. You know, it was not Shambhala. It was not a paradise on earth. It was a political system like any other, and it had corruption. And it had some strange practices that the outside world thought were just too bizarre to be allowed to survive.
Hmm. What about the, I mean, considering your background in studying the Nazis and all that, the Nazi expeditions that were being made in the, was it early 30s or maybe mid-30s to Tibet, could it be in some kind of weird way the arm of the occult forces here be reaching to Tibet through or via China in any way? Could it be that they want to, in some way, try to get access to the knowledge there? And the best way of doing this is, of course, by suppressing the people, suppressing their religious ideas and teaching, and hence kind of, get the information out of that country, if you will.
Well, one of the things that, since you bring this up, it's very interesting. One of the things that always has concerned me is that during the Cultural Revolution, many of the temples in Tibet, some very ancient ones, were of course destroyed or painted over. Their icons were painted over. But what really concerned me, perhaps even more, is what happened to all the libraries. What happened to all the books? Were they burned, or were they captured and taken back to Beijing or some other place? And this is a mystery so far. We really don't know this very well. I've been trying to find out a number of things that took place in China in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and it's very, very difficult to do that. Trying to locate this type of information is almost impossible. I'm hoping that if I keep at it long enough, eventually I'll pry something loose. But I think that the Chinese themselves were definitely anti-religious, where they saw religion as the absolute enemy, that I don't think they had the same approach that the Nazis did. The Nazis did not see religion as the enemy. They saw Catholicism as the enemy, Christianity, Judaism as the enemy, and even Islam as the enemy. But they did not see religion per se. They believed in a kind of pagan religion that they wanted to bring back. China had nothing like that during the revolution. They wanted to suppress all religion completely. So I think they may have viewed the Nazi expedition to Tibet as pure superstition, or they may have seen it cynically as the Nazis' attempt to co-opt Tibetan religion and Tibetan practices to build another front against the British in India. I mean, there's all sorts of things that could have been going on. I think the Chinese would have taken the cynical point of view. So I don't believe that the Chinese were secretly looking for Tibetan knowledge. I think they may have poo-pooed that completely. But at the same time, what happened to those libraries? What happened to all of those scrolls? What happened to all the documents that that were kept there? I mean, the lamas were able to take some of them out of Tibet when they fled into India, into Nepal. But there was a lot that had to be left behind, and I'm very curious as to what happened to that.
And if we talk about the Chinese, the communist revolution, I mean, it seems to me that it's been kind of ongoing in one way to kind of break down the previous Chinese traditions from, I don't know, from the, 1910 or something like that, all the way up to after World War II, almost up to 1950. We had different, wars going on back and forth and so forth. But, I mean, China is an ancient empire. It's been long around for a long time. How do you think it is that communism just could come in and kind of take over so easily in a way?
Well, it's an interesting point, too. It's something that I've often wondered about for various reasons, especially because China itself is not really one country. And the Chinese will hate me for saying this, but there's no such thing, for instance, as the Chinese language. Let's be blunt about this. Mm. Not all the Chinese speak the same language. There's virtually no similarity between Cantonese, for instance, and Mandarin, no matter what they tell you. They can try to explain it. They can try to find a way. But believe me, if you're a Cantonese speaker, you do not understand Mandarin. And if you're a Mandarin speaker, you are lost with Cantonese or Hokkien or any of the other dialects. These are all different languages with different tonal structures. The only thing they have in common is the written word. This was the genius of Chinese calligraphy, Chinese characters, is that they were not phonetically connected. In other words, I could write a character, you could pronounce it one way, I'll pronounce it another way, but the meaning is the same. And that was the brilliance of creating this written language. It unified a country where everybody was speaking their own language, essentially, but they could communicate using the written word because the characters meant the same. I think that communism, when Mao brought it in, he essentially, as the Chinese like to say, it's Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. And I think what he was able to do was create a kind of communism that everybody could agree with, a kind of movement that, even though each individual warlord had their own interests, each individual territory had their own interests, the intellectuals were one group and the workers were another, the peasants and the factory workers. But they could all kind of agree on this because it was their identity. It protected them against the outside. And I think that's what they really wanted. They were invaded by Japan. They had Russia they were dealing with the Russian-Chinese confrontations of the late 19th, early 20th century. They had the Japanese incursions. They had Westerners there, like crazy, who were in bed with the Empress Dowager, figuratively anyway. And she was selling out the country. So the Chinese eventually at one point, as a group, they got together and said, this is it. This is enough. They saw Chiang Kai-shek as a puppet of Western interests. They did not want the West to come back in and run their country. They had dealt with the opium wars, having opium, shoved down their throats. So I think it was a kind of ethnophobia that allowed Mao and communism to take root in China. This was so radical. There were no kings. There were no queens. You know, it was a completely unique, pure creation for China at that time. And I think they embraced it for that reason. It was going to protect them against the West, and it was going to give them pride as a country, as a unified country, regardless of their languages and their backgrounds.
Yet the philosophy of communism is Western, if we want to look at it from that point of view. And they allowed that philosophy in one way to kind of infiltrate them or take them over in that way, right?
Well, exactly. That's the irony of this whole thing. I mean, Karl Marx obviously was not Chinese, and he was the ultimate Westerner in a sense, because he was fighting against the Industrial Revolution. He was fighting against the things that were causing all this damage to take place in the West, things that had not happened yet in China. And part of my arguments with the Chinese when I was there, and I've been there a lot over the last 25 years, I've often argued with them over this fact that they could not have communism in China. It was not ready. According to Marx, you had to go through various phases. You had to go through a feudal period, you know, you had to go through the Industrial Revolution period, a capitalist phase, et cetera, et cetera. You could not suddenly create communism overnight. And we went through this a lot of argumentation over this concept. And I told it failed in Russia for the same reason. They didn't go through an Industrial Revolution phase. They didn't go through a workers in the factory phase. They didn't go through a capitalist phase. Well, now China is going through a capitalist phase. And I just know there are party members there, the old school, the people who marched on the Long March with Mao, who are sitting back and thinking, well, we have to go through this now in order to achieve true communism. You know, I think in the back of their minds, this is only a stepping stone towards complete socialism and communism. And I think that's what they're thinking.
Well, that is interesting, isn't it? Do you think that it could be, the ultimate socialist goal of actually having a world empire in that sense, and with the aid of the Chinese, this is how it will be done? They understood that we have to use capitalism in order to kind of destroy it, if you will. Do you think that that's what they're going for here?
Well, in a sense, I think that, you know, I don't think they were listening to me and my arguments, but I think it's been pretty much a lot of people have been saying this for a while, that, you know, communism wasn't working because nobody listened to Marx. Nobody followed the historical necessity that Marx said communism was inevitable in history as long as it went through these various phases. And it's possible. I mean, George Soros recently famously declared that, you know, China was going to be the next empire.
Yep.
You might as well just sit back and enjoy it, because that is what was going to happen. Well, imagine if that is true. Capitalism does not equal democracy. And that's something that in the West we've heard too many times, that there's some kind of equation between capitalism and democracy. Free markets means, you know, a democratic government, a democratic form of government. Not necessarily. You know, that's not necessarily true. And I think the Chinese look at it that way. It's a controlled economy in China. It still is. The government still controls that economy. They control the value of the yen. They control what is exported and what is imported. They have a lot of control over the system. They can step in at any time and close it down if they wanted to, which is what we don't have in the United States, as an example. So I think that in the back of their minds, they're thinking, we want to create still this idea of a workers' paradise. The problem was we were exploited for too long by the West, because they had capitalism. They had the technology that we needed. We had to get that technology. Well, guess what? Now we have it. We have pretty much everything we need from the West. We're still trying to, you know, steal some secrets here and there, and there's still this kind of corporate industrial espionage going on and that sort of thing. But for the most part, the Chinese have a handle now on technology. I mean, they're sending ships into space. You know, they have an active electronic infrastructure in China. So at this point, they're saying to themselves, what's the next step for China? You know, a peaceful empire, one that can convert rather than invade. And I think the Chinese are looking forward to something like that. I think they want to gradually overtake economies, gradually overtake ways of living, ways of approaching things in different countries. Not today and not tomorrow. But perhaps in the next 30 to 50 years, you may see China becoming more and more of the superpower that the United States once was. But in a different way, economically, for sure. The weakness in China, though, and there is a tremendous flaw in the system, is raw materials. They are desperate for raw materials. They've been seeking them around the world. They are desperate for petroleum. They're competing with us tremendously for petroleum. They're adding 1 million cars. I forget what the statistic was, every month or so in China. They need the petroleum to fuel their economy. They're looking for alternate sources of fuel, alternate sources of energy. They are desperate for that, which they don't really have. Most of that country is desert. People don't realize that about China, but most of that country is not arable land. They've burned most of their trees. They have very few trees. They don't really have a lot of livestock in the Western sense of having acres and acres of cattle. They don't have this in China. So they have a different economy and a different approach to energy utilization. This may be a strength in the long run, but right now it's a weakness in the country.
I mean, the Soviet Union failed, and with that many people have said that the communist experiment failed. And the question, of course, is even though you have a system like this coming in with suppression on, and all that, and you mentioned that capitalism isn't democratic in that sense, and I would say neither is communism. And the question then is, if this runs its course, so to speak, the question is, how do you prevent people then from ultimately rising up? If you're looking from this from the point of view of being the leader of a nation like this, or trying to manage such a huge population, and still having a dictatorship in there, because ultimately the better people get it in China, I would reckon that more and more would stand up, that would demand, you know, to get equal rights and vote issues and all this stuff. Is that something you think that they want to give to people, or do they need to suppress and keep the dictatorship in place, so to speak?
Well, from my point of view, I think what the Chinese are doing is they realize something that we used to do back in the old days is to rely on bread and circus. You know, as long as they feel that the Chinese have enough to eat, as their people have enough to eat, and they're entertained and they're distracted by these material benefits that they've been getting, and they are growing a middle class in China. There was not a middle class even 30 years ago. There was no middle class, but now there's a growing middle class. I think as the government feels, as long as everybody is actively involved and distracted, no one's going to demand the right to vote. No one's going to demand all of these various liberties. Because China can always point to the West and say, you know, look what happened over there. You don't want to, you know, go through this again, do you? So they remember their own history very well. They remember how they were suffering under the emperors and then suffering under various forms of foreign intervention. So I think they have a tendency to support their government and to give their government some space in which to move. There will always be people who will resist the government, and they will resist the kind of suppression that takes place. Falun Gong is being a famous example. Yeah. But I don't think in general, right now, I don't think the Chinese people are getting ready to cause any problems there. The only people who are going to be very angry, and they are right now, are the people who are poor, the people that used to have jobs under a state-controlled economy, what they call the iron rice bowl. It meant your rice bowl could never be broken because you'd always have a job. You were guaranteed an income for life. That has stopped for the large part. There are still some state-controlled enterprises. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, that's gone. So you've created this entire class of people who have no skills, who, while they were working in factories, really did basically nothing, that I can attest from having visited so many factories and seen so many workers sort of just sitting around. Mm-hmm. So they have no skills. They have nothing to contribute, but also no opportunity. And that's going to be China's big task. That's why they're creating so many social programs right now, is to try to stop this before it becomes a political problem for them. They don't need a couple of million Chinese. And in China, a couple of million is a couple of percentage points. But they don't need a couple of million Chinese suddenly deciding to revolt. Hmm. That they don't need. So they're wise. I've been watching China, and they just have yet to make any mistakes in the last 20 years or so. They've been kind of... except for Tiananmen Square, which, you know, we contributed, America contributed that to some extent, to the bad feelings over it. But Tiananmen Square is probably the litmus test for the government and how they're going to handle that in the future. If they're going to come out and say, yeah, it was a mistake. If they do that, I think a lot of Chinese will breathe a sigh of relief and will get on with their lives. But Tiananmen Square is still a sticking point. And it was the students who caused that, who created that. It was students living in the cities who could not earn extra income to pay for rising costs in the universities. They're the ones who mistakenly thought that democracy and capitalism were the same. And that's why you had the Statue of Liberty in Tiananmen Square. They didn't really want democracy, I think, from my point of view. What they wanted was what they thought democracy could bring them, which was capitalism. Hmm. Well, now they have capitalism.
Yeah, that's right.
So maybe they don't need democracy, you see. We'll wait and see. I mean, there are different people with different attitudes. We'll wait and see what their values become in the years to come. Their own culture has become dominant in the region. Chinese culture, Chinese popular music and literature, films have taken on a life and a strength of their own. So not importing as much from the West as they used to. They're not idolizing Western values as much as they used to. What they used to call spiritual pollution, which was virtually anything from the West. So now it's become a different thing. Now they're proud of their own culture, of their own capabilities, not only in making money, but also in developing culture. This is what creates a very strong country, and this is what we have to look at and observe very carefully in the years to come.
Yes, and regarding language and all this, and considering that there's many schism then in the Chinese society, do you see that this the government will attempt to, I guess, centralize China more or make it more homogenous in that sense, that they will try to bring it more together? And adding on to that question, is there any talk at all in China on larger expanding unions, like, for instance, the North American Union or the European Union, but in the Chinese or Asian context? Do you know?
Sure. Both of those questions are linked. In the first place, China, because of Mandarin, they have been using Mandarin as the official language in all of China. When I first went to China and I was in South China in Guangdong province, Canton province, I used to see these big signs that said in Chinese, "A comrade, please speak Mandarin," you know. Mm. So they were trying to force everyone to speak Mandarin. That was supposed to be their universal language. And then leaders of the provinces were moved around considerably to make sure that there were Mandarin-speaking sort of northern Chinese people controlling the southern provinces and the other provinces around China. And then there was movement of people within China. Until recently, when you graduated university, you were told where you were going to work, in what part of China. You were sent there. That was your work unit, as they say. And you had a little book, and that was connected to where you worked. That was your identity. You worked in that factory, and it could be on the other side of China, and you may never see your birthplace again, you know, except maybe on a holiday if you could afford the train ticket back. So there was this desperate attempt to homogenize China. It began with the emperors, with the use of the written language, but then with Mao, it really became very, very necessary. The Russians did the same thing in Ukraine and Belarus and those places. They imposed their language, they imposed their culture, and tried to eradicate the local cultures. Well, the same thing was happening in China. And at this point, it's been kind of successful, I would say about 50-50. I mean, you're still going to hear Cantonese in Canton province. There's no getting rid of it. Shanghainese in Shanghai, et cetera, et cetera. They're still speaking their own language amongst themselves. But to foreigners or to officially in government circles, it's always going to be Mandarin. So that's kind of worked. Mm. But as far as an Asian union, of course, the Japanese tried that during World War II. There was an attempt by China. They've been active participants in Asia-Pacific meetings and conferences. They're there all the time. They're kind of sinister to some of the countries. They're afraid of Chinese influence being, because they're so powerful. But at the same time, I think that China has shown itself to be more of a friend to Asia in general than a friend to anyone else. So I think the Asians are feeling a bit more comfortable having China sit on the board of these Asia-Pacific conferences and meetings and the various annual meetings they have throughout Southeast Asia, for instance. So I think that China's presence is there, and I think that there is a desire to create a kind of NAFTA for Asia, you know, a free trade system of free trade arrangements. They're already involved with free trade discussions in South America and in Africa and the Middle East. So they're trying to create this kind of economic environment where they'll be free to move goods back and forth and currency back and forth. I think this is their goal in the short term.
I have two more points or questions that I want to fire away to you, and then we can take a little break and then continue actually talking about the Masons, shift a little bit gear here. But there is one thing I heard here the other day in terms of the relationship between China and Africa as well, that the work force, so to speak, and what is needed or demanded rather on the world scene from China, they're also taking help now from Africa. And to explain it this way, it seems to me that there is an overarching view here of the, if we look at it from the point of view of the New World Order or the global government that seems to be, you know, developing right now. And under this guise is this idea, this kind of dream put forth that, okay, we will, once we do all the nations, we industrialize them, we make them a bit better in terms of you know, wealth and welfare and schools, hospitals, etc. We will have, you know, world peace pretty much. And now what I've heard then is that through China, Africa is being helped up to this level as well. I think that this overarching idea, of course, is what we're being sold in order to swallow the New World Order idea. But just to point out that the relationship between China and Africa, is that true from your perspective? Have you seen that China is starting to work more and more with Africa now as well, Peter?
I believe that China is, the evidence is there. China has been involved with Africa for decades. We just haven't noticed it until recently. But they've been involved for decades. They've been involved with Nigeria because of petroleum. There's no question about that. They've been involved in the Middle East for the same reasons. They've been involved in various parts of Africa because of their thirst for raw materials. That's been a major concern for them. But also they see Africa as the ignored continent. Europe doesn't do that much. The U.S. does virtually nothing beyond a few aid programs and things like this. Africa does not show up for most Americans on their radar screen at all. It's become more of a problem in Europe because of North Africans going into Europe, and Islam has become an issue. So people are more, I think, aware of it in Europe, but mostly because of the Islamic problem that's perceived. But I think that China is very definitely building good relationships in Africa. They have begun to understand that they have to give back to Africa, to invest in Africa. They're throwing money around in Africa more than we do from the United States. So if you worry about a new world order, I think the new world order was a Western European American concept. I think that China would resist a new world order. They may want their own new world order. They may want a Chinese world order. I think that's the dream of some of their geopoliticians. But that may be the negative pole to the new world order that's been discussed so much and is being trying to create so many times with many false starts in the West. I think the Chinese may be actually a solution to that by creating their own polarity against it. China is not going to share power with anyone, let's face it. Not at this point. China's become too strong. They've become too proud. They've become too filled with their own sense of possibility and potential. I don't see China sharing power right now. I don't think they have to. They don't see the need for it yet. So for that reason, I think that it's safe to say China would not deliberately become involved in this. There may be some individuals in China, some politicians who are looking to do this. I don't think it's going to be a political platform for that country, certainly not for the Communist Party. They could see an international communist movement, a Comintern, come back again and try to install communism around the world. But they can't do that yet in China till they have communism in China, you see. Mm. They don't really have it yet. So they've got to finish their experiment first. They've got to actually create, you know, a communist society in China before they can export it to the rest of the world, I think, which is why the Maoist groups in South America and in Nepal and places like that have been so miserable as far as not being able to succeed very well. China is very reluctant to export that kind of militant communism abroad until they can figure out what they're doing, you know, at home.
And, of course, that could potentially lead the kind of tug of war that you're describing a little bit between these geopolitical forces that is going on between China and the West. That could potentially even lead up to another war between these, a major war between the West and China, possibly even teaming up with Russia. Are you worried about that at all?
Well, I'm about as worried about it now as I was back in the 1980s, when that still seemed like a possibility. Russia and China were still cooperating heavily until I began to realize the Chinese really didn't like the Russians. And the Russians were really kicking them around and acting like they were the parent and China was the child, where communism was concerned. So there was a lot of animosity there. A military conflict, China has famously been trying to stay out of military conflicts. I think they would see that as bad for business right now. Think of the Chinese as the mafia, and think of the Communist Party as the godfather, you know, where violence in the movies, in the mafia movies, is constant. But in actuality, the mafia feels that violence is bad for business. And I think China looks at it that way, too. I don't think China would get involved in a war unless it was good for business. And the only other caveat, I would say, is the possibility of a war with Taiwan still exists. But I think that what China is doing is clever. They're basically taking Taiwan over in terms of trade. And I think we have to look at that as the example China is going to use in the future. There are so many Taiwanese businesses that now are based in China and vice versa that there's almost no difference between these two countries at this point. There's a political difference, certainly, but it's largely aesthetic. You know, it's a cosmetic difference. I think that there's a lot of Taiwanese who hate China, of course, but there's so many Taiwanese who are tired of the conflict and want to be part of China. So I think their use of military power, I don't see it in the short term. I don't see them trying to do that. They are still not a military power on the par with, for instance, the United States. Mm. I think they are still not. They have a lot of people under arms. They have a lot of, you know, foot soldiers. But as far as serious strategic weaponry, they're still behind, and I think they don't want to get into that. They really do not want to get into that. They will exert pressure, and they will cooperate with Russia, I believe, especially where oil is concerned. They'll make some deals, and they'll try to create a kind of a trade bloc, perhaps, and they will try to influence foreign policy in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Europe. I think that's a definite possibility. But as far as a shooting war, I don't think China's ready for that yet, not yet. I think they want to make sure they consolidate their position first.
All right, there we go. We've primarily here been talking about Peter's books, The Mao of Business, Guerrilla Trade Techniques for the New China. And we've also discussed a little bit about his book, Stairway to Heaven, Chinese Alchemist, Jewish Kabbalist, and the Art of Spiritual Transformation. And Peter, is Amazon the best place for our listeners to go if they want to pick up copies of your books?
Yes, Amazon and barnesandnoble.com, they're probably the best places to go.
How about your website, by the way? Are you intending to have that back up and running?
Yes, we've had some problems with it, and I think they changed the server. So at this point, they're trying to get the sites back up and running. We've had problems. We've had the site hacked so many times. I had an article about John McCain that people thought was not nice, and I think it was hacked for that reason. I claimed he was a Manchurian candidate. And so what happened was the story got picked up worldwide. It got picked up in Washington. It got picked up in all over Europe. And then suddenly our site went down and the article disappeared. So I don't know what happened. But
well, there you go.
Someone took exception.
Okay. Well, anyway, if our, any of you out there listening to this in our archives or in the future, if the site is back up, go to sinisterforces.info to find more information about Peter and his work, of course. But with that, thank you very much for this first segment, Peter. Stay with us then, and we'll be back more here on The Masons soon. Join us for our second hour with Peter Lavenda as we're going to talk more about Masonry, their rituals, their origins, and also about the many denominations that exists, the Knights Templar, the Illuminati, and of course the Catholic connection. We also discuss the initiation ritual, what happens to you when you go through a ritual like this. What role does trauma play into this, and can we view it as a form of mind control, or at least more mildly put, alteration of your consciousness? The question is what that does to you. We talk about the need for people to belong to any organization and the problem of secrecy, secret societies and their occult rituals. We talk about the building of Solomon's Temple, religion, the Jewish roots of Masonry, but also Skull and Bones, military lodges, the Manchurian candidate, the elite and leaders that are above the law. A very interesting hour two with Peter Lavenda coming up for subscribers to Red Eyes. Click on members or subscribe from our front page, redeyescreations.com, to read more about how to sign up and get access to this and all of our radio, webcast, video interview, and film archives. We will be back with more radio soon. Nick Rosen will join us to talk about how to escape from the Big Brother system and how to live off-grid. We'll have John Cale with us to talk about the Masonic star map of Charleston in South Carolina. We also have Sabina DeVita joining us to discuss electromagnetic pollution, a hidden stress to your system. We'll take a short break here, but hour two is coming up.